nobody seems to talk about the percentage chance of being disabled in our lives, whether we're congenitally disabled or whether we'd become disabled later in our lives. I can't find that stat. But I'm very, very aware that one day I'm going to be disabled. And that's where, it's not where my passion comes from. My passion came from working for Guide Dogs for the Blind for 18 years and working alongside people that needed support. So that's where the passion comes from.
Hi, I'm Brooke Milhouse. Welcome to Disabled and Proud, the podcast that does exactly what it says on the tin. Each week, the show highlights an awesome disabled guest speaking about their own disability, why they're proud to be disabled, and why they're proud to be themselves. Gavin, welcome to Disabled and Proud. How are you today?
I am absolutely brilliant today, apart from the fact that I woke up this morning, opened the curtains, snow. And I'm in Edinburgh. What the heck? Snow.
Snow.
Seriously?
We're in spring. Look. Oh my goodness.
That's been melting for a while. So yeah, I've got snow. And I'm looking after a husky dog, and it went straight outside and ran around the garden like crazy. It was like, yeah, I'm back in the Antarctic or something, wherever they're from.
So this episode of Disabled and Proud is a little bit different. And that is because you work in disability. You're not necessarily disabled. Or you maybe say you're pre-disabled, because at some point everybody is going to be disabled. Like, healthcare is making us live longer, therefore you've got more chance of becoming disabled at some point in time, or maybe something will, you'll acquire a disability at some point in time. But for now, can you explain how what you do relates to the disabled community?
Well, I would definitely go along with you saying non-disabled. I am currently non-disabled. But it's only a matter of time. It's only a matter of time. I know when I was 40, I had a brain hemorrhage, and I was very, very lucky to survive that, I was told at the time, but I had made a full recovery. I've got arthritis in my knees, but that just means it's harder to get up and down and stuff like that, do a bit of yoga and try and sort of get around that. I had two back operations in my 20s and 30s that could quite easily have taken me into that. And now, being 55, a little bit gray, a little bit old, I'm heading into the territory of somebody who's going to have age-related conditions. My eyesight's going, my hearing will be going. So I'm going to be disabled sooner or later. When I looked for a stat around this, I couldn't find a stat. Nobody seems to talk about the percentage chance of being disabled in our lives, whether we're congenitally disabled or whether we become disabled later in our lives. Mm-hmm. I can't find that stat. So maybe one of your listeners might put it in the comments, wherever your comments appear. But I'm very, very aware that one day I'm going to be disabled. And that's where, it's not where my passion comes from. My passion came from working for Guide Dogs for the Blind for 18 years and working alongside mm-hmm. people that needed support. So that's where the passion comes from.
Yeah, it is. It's so interesting, isn't it? Because we've obviously just spoken about NADEX, which is obviously like almost like Disable Fest on steroids, because it's 2 days where the disabled community are all in one space and one area. And realistically, like, you don't see that many disabled people in that type of space ever in society. So it's almost like this whole hub, and it's crazy and it's intense. And you get to speak to people and meet people. But something someone said to me at NADEX was this idea of referring to people as pre-disabled because of healthcare, because of age-related conditions. At some point in time, disability will touch you, whether that's you personally or like a family member, whatever, like you will be touched by it at some point in time. And also, let's not forget, disability doesn't discriminate. But this idea of like pre-disabled, age-related conditions is something that we really forget about. We never have that conversation. And I'm not surprised that you can't find that stat, because I'm pretty sure nobody has actually done the research into it, because we all know that, you know, disabled people don't necessarily deserve stats and figures. Full sarcasm, by the way, like, we deserve it more than most. But that research isn't there. So I'm just not surprised that you haven't found it. But let's talk about your career with, what was it, Guide Dogs?
I was military police for 10 years as a young chap, and I had police attack dogs, not the big nasty ones with lots of teeth that bite criminals. I did that in the RAF, and then from 86 until 96, and then I was based at RAF Lucas, which is in Scotland near Dundee, and just north of Dundee is Forfar, which is where there was a guide dog school, and I used to go along and do voluntary work for the guide dog school, showing people around the kennels and talking about guide dogs. And then I was looking for a career that I could do after I left the military. I didn't want to full do 22 years in the military. 10 years was enough, although I loved it. But I just thought, oh, I wonder if I could work for guide dogs. Being a guide dog trainer would be great. And I did voluntary work, as I said. But eventually, when I applied for a job to become a dog trainer, the management there said, we would prefer it if you applied for to become a guide dog mobility instructor. So it was actually working with the person rather than the dogs. You work with the dogs a little bit, but then you hand the dog on to the person, and then that's the last time you even interact with the dog. You're just interacting with the dog.
Okay,
the person.
So you're like the pre person before the person gets the dog.
I am the pre person before the person gets the dog. That was not my title. I was called the guide dog mobility instructor, but that's exactly what I did. I was the pre person who was the person before the person gets the dog. But I handed the dog over to the person, and then the person learned how to use the dog with just me sort of like whispering in their ear. And then as they got more competent and they bonded with the dog, I would get further and further away. And then I would observe them from a distance. And then instead of talking to them at every down curb or up curb or wherever they were going, I would talk to them at the end of a walk. And I would say, oh, have you tried this? Or what did you think of that? Or what might you do in the future with this situation? So you get more and more hands off. And I got so much from that. It was the best job in the world. I mean, I absolutely loved the last day of training where the person went off down the street on their own and you just went, yes,
yes,
because it's all about independence and choice and the freedom to do what you want to do when you want to do it. Of course, we all know with discrimination being such a massive issue, it's not the freedom of choice. It's the freedom of, well, it's the freedom of choice, but it's not the freedom of equity within how people interact with you. And that's the thing that the red mist came down. I get red mist. I'm a really soft, gentle guy. I've probably never been in a fight in my life. But I get red mist when I see people littering on purpose. I don't mind something dropping out your pocket. But if somebody goes, there you go, drop that out the window of your car, I'm like, I'm up for a fight. But if I see, if I experience hate crime, or if I see even just discrimination with a small d, i.e. somebody saying something like, oh, you've been in the wars, haven't you? Or what's wrong with you? Which is kind of small level discrimination that if you get it six times in a day, you might not be so happy to leave your house the next day. But that stuff riled me up constantly. And I would always not wanting to be a white knight, but wanting to be an ally. I just wanted to try and address that if I could.
Yeah. I think what you said just then about equity of experience is something that a lot of people really forget, is that equality and equity are two very different things. And then there's equity and experience. And I like that was a really valuable point for me, because I don't think people fully understand what equity of experience is. And considering this is kind of your realm and like what you do, I was wondering if you could just explain that just a little bit for listeners so they can really grasp what that concept is.
Yeah, so there was one thing that I was explaining there about what I did as a job and how I got further away from my client. But when the person finished their training course and they went home, and then I would go home with them, and then I would watch them working in their home environment, or more, every single time we would end up going to a particular venue or location, and then I would stand back and then watch how they interacted with the staff member and then how the staff member interacted with them. And I was always thinking to myself, why didn't the staff member do this or this or this? Because that would have been so much easier. And if they'd had training, they would maybe have put that into practice. So what I used to do is I used to go up and speak to the staff member after the interaction. And I would say, next time you meet Michael or whatever the person's name was, make sure that you do this, 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 and this, and this. Maybe five things. Because it's going to make everybody's life so much easier. And instead of you being uncomfortable and them feeling a little bit uncomfortable or frustrated, it's going to mean your relationship's improved. And the staff member would go, oh, yeah, that's really, really useful. But there was no guarantee that they were going to remember what I said to them, because they probably weren't in learning mode at that moment. They're probably like, oh, no, seriously, I think I've just messed up, or I've just said something wrong, or I just touched their dog and they had to get angry with their dog because the dog got up, or whatever it might be. So they're not necessarily in learning mode. But then I got into the habit of running ahead of my client when I knew they were going into a certain shop. And then I would speak to the staff member before my client walked through the door. So I'd say, right, somebody's going to walk through the door in a couple of minutes' time. They're visually impaired. They've got a guide dog. Please introduce yourself. Please do not talk to the guide dog. Please, and I did it in a nice way. I did it in a really friendly way. Please don't, if you're giving them sighted guide, don't just grab their arm and move. Just offer your arm. Or ask them if they would like sighted guide. And they invariably were like, oh, that's really good. Thanks very much. And then I would stand back, watch my client come through the door, and I would see a totally different interaction. And I was like, oh, wow. Mm. If I could, this is the way my brain worked at the time. If I could run ahead of every single disabled person on the planet and go into a shop beforehand, well, wait a second, what if it wasn't me? What if somebody ran ahead? That would be brilliant, wouldn't it? Because then we would get rid of this discrimination, high level or low level. But I couldn't because there's only one of me and I was only there for that day. So it was impossible. So I couldn't fix it. I just had to be frustrated.
Mm-hmm. And that's, it's really interesting, like you said, like running ahead and kind of being able to give support where it's necessary on both like sides of the knife. Because on one hand, you're giving support to the person with the guide dog who, you know, they're learning, they're training, they're building their relationship with that animal. But equally also when we're thinking about running ahead into the store and being able to support them to be able to support a disabled person to their best of abilities, that's a very interesting place to be. And something you said about giving someone the ability to have a nice experience whilst they're out and about, without that discrimination, without that unknowing of whether this interaction is going to be positive or negative, is actually really invaluable. And how does that tie into what you do now?
Well, just to sort of reiterate what you're saying there, we've all heard, your listeners definitely will have heard of the End Loneliness Campaign, which was Joe Cox that set this foundation up about ending loneliness for anybody. But of course, we've got all these people around the country who are afraid to leave their house or anxious about going to places because of all the anxiety around it. But for disabled people, that's even greater. Will I be discriminated against? Am I going to go to a restaurant or will I just get order in? Will I buy something from a shop or will I just buy it on Amazon? Do I feel comfortable going out to enjoy a movie or a museum or an art gallery? Or am I better off just staying at home and consuming in that way? And I was like, well, there must be a way of actually fixing that. And I think it was back in 2007, somebody turned up to train with a guide dog and they took a mobile phone out, and the mobile phone, they were using VoiceOver and the phone was talking to them. And I was like, well, that's really cool. And I bought myself an iPhone and I learned how to use VoiceOver. And then it wasn't immediate because my brain didn't work like that. But over a couple of years, I was like, well, wouldn't it be good if my client could communicate directly with the venue before they walk through the door? Not by phoning them and saying I'm coming, because you've no guarantee you're going to meet the person or have the right phone number or stuff like that. But what if I had some sort of digital interaction where I could, through the process of having a profile that I've already got in an app, what if that could trigger training and awareness of not just me as a disabled person, but also what if I could ask them for something before I turned up? So I'm looking to buy some new jeans. I'm wanting to find out more about your accessible PCs. I'm wanting to, I've got an interest in such and such a display that you have at the museum just now that was of interest to me. What if I could put that information in? And it took me several years because I'm not a bear of immense talent, but I went, I can do this. I could actually do this. And the more I investigated it, I realized that nobody had ever done it before. And by 2018, it took that long, I had launched the world's first proximity-based staff training tool for disability.
That in itself is a mission, but also being able to realise where there is a gap in the market, particularly for disabled people, because quite often we're left, our market type thing is completely left to the wayside. We're not thought about when it comes to training or, you know, hospitable environments. You know, we think about restaurants, we think about shops. You know, I've worked in retail and we were given absolutely no training on disability, like none. And I worked for a pretty effing big store that has big, like, all across the world, big brand, it's a well-known shop. And at no point were we ever given that training. So to be able to kind of create that and create a space where you could learn and provide that culture that fosters, you know, no discrimination, but also, you know, an ability to learn and ask questions, particularly surrounding disability, and is really invaluable. And what was, like, obviously you said you really don't like discrimination. You worked with, like, guide dogs, you've worked with blind people, but what was it that really made you want to work within the disabled community?
Well, that's a super question. That goes right back to my childhood, I think, probably. I wasn't thinking disability at the time, but I grew up in the Highlands of Scotland. My dad was a mountain rescue leader. We would go out and the mountain rescue dogs would be out there, and we were every weekend my dad would have stories of going out onto the mountains and hopefully rescuing people or terribly bringing people home in body bags on occasion and stuff like this, because it's a dangerous place to be. And then I was a policeman when I joined the forces, and I was like, I've always had this moral compass that said the right thing to do. If you do it, it's the right thing to do. I'm proudly woke. I can see the challenges around the worst side of the spectrum of wokeness, which is where the right always focus on. They're like, oh, but what about this, the most terrible thing? And then you go, yeah, but what about this, which is the thing that needs to be fixed? Let's not just say it's bad because of the thing on that side. So I've spent my life, my mum was a massive moral compass to me, and she always brought me up to have this moral compass. And I think military police or mountain rescue, military police, and then more socially connected with charity, and then being surrounded by people who I didn't see as disabled. I mean, I find it really hard to identify somebody else as disabled before I identify them as Mark or Matthew or John or Fred or Frida or Joan. I see them, and then I see the barriers that face them rather than their disability. Of course, I take into account pain and mental anguish and challenge and all those things, but I look at the world as a series of barriers that have been created because we've grown up in the last few hundred years of being in a country or world where the people who were disabled weren't catered for because they weren't required in society. Because the people who were required, and I have inverted commas around this, were working in fields and doing all that. And they didn't do access to work. They didn't do what can I do to make you feel more valued. It was like, well, look, we're going to have to do too much to change. We can't change everything just to make you feel valued. If you can do it, you can do it. But the world changed. And because we've designed it so badly, we've just got a world full of barriers because of the poor design. And I just want to, instead of helping people over the barrier, I just want to remove the barriers, which is what Welcome does.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting what you said about kind of the Industrial Revolution, really, because a lot of the Industrial Revolution is kind of to blame with how the world, particularly the working world, is set up, and that's like the reason we work 9 to 5 is because that's when there was sunlight and you know, electricity wasn't a thing, so we work during those hours because that's when you get the most daylight. And we think about disabled people not working, it's not because we didn't want to, it's because, you know, we had to have these like quote-unquote able bodies to be able to do the manual labor. Now we think technology has moved on, we've moved on, we haven't quite caught up just as well. And you're right, you know, disabled people weren't like required in the workspace or, you know, required in actual societal living, because it was very much like, okay, if you can't complete this task, you're behind closed doors and we're going to hide you because it's an embarrassment that you can't carry on and you can't do this, which is why, you know, disability wasn't spoken about for so long, and it's why it was left in the shadows. But that in itself, you know, being able to tie that into technology is really quite valuable, but also being able to see it as well. Like you said that you see people's barriers, you see the things that stop them doing stuff beforehand. And I think, is that because through what you've done in career-wise, your perception has had to be so bang on nearly a good 99% of the time, because if it wasn't, you'd fail at your job? Do you think that probably fostered that ability to see beforehand?
Well, look, if you're walking up the street and you're following a guide dog owner or a long cane user, and obviously I was following these people, but if you're following that person up the street and you can see that a push bike on the pavement or a wheelie bin or a car parked badly or a scooter is on the pavement and the dog stops And then the person goes, I don't know what they said, and then they have to do some checks, and they have to do some turns, and then they have to ask the dog to try and find the way, and then they run the risk of falling or tripping or hurting their ankle, and then they get round to a curb edge, and then there isn't a drop curb, or the traffic lights are too far away, or they get to a door, and then they can't get through the door, or they stumble because there's a step that's incorrect height, or then they have to press a button to get through a door when everybody is next to them going through a door which doesn't need a button, and then you walk in, and then the person doesn't interact with them in a way that is useful to them or makes them feel as if they're not welcome. And you suddenly go, what? And you can't do that every single day without getting truly frustrated that the day that you leave them, they're going to be dealing with that every single day. And they are the tip of the iceberg. There are 3,500, 4,000 guide dog owners in the UK, but there are 300,000 visually impaired people. And a lot of them aren't getting the support that they need. And that is a fraction of the 16.2 or 16.4 million disabled people in the UK, or the 1.3 billion worldwide, who are living every day facing barriers that a lot of other people don't have to face. There are barriers for everybody. Of course there are. But these are extra barriers. These are added barriers for disabled people. And we need them in society.
Yeah. I love these conversations because they take so many twists and turns and not where I was expecting them to go. It's so good. But what I'm really interested in is, so obviously you've worked with charity, you've worked in the disabled community, you do work in the disabled community. But because you don't classify as disabled, how has the reception been from the disabled community?
Well, there will be lots of people who are watching this who know me, and there will be even more who don't know me. But the people who've known me for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, they know that I cut me in half and I will bleed to the point of being sickening, the amount of like, come on, fix this. People who don't know me, I think, not a problem. Get to know me. If you will, please take some time to get to know me and the other allies that are out there. We're no longer the white knights that we used to be. We're not there because we want to be told thank you and it's great that I'm a poor disabled person and look at you, non-disabled or able-bodied person helping me. I don't feel the need for that at all. That's a new level of allyship that's out there where people are just wanting equity and fairness and diversity in the world around them. And I believe I'm part of that. But when I'm met by somebody who goes, I'm a bit cynical about this guy, I go, I understand that. Let's be friends. I say things that I hope will be, oh, yeah, how would he possibly know that? How is he friends with those people? How are they friendly with him? Why are people talking about him when he's not there and saying positive things? And I very much hope that the people who know me do say positive things about me, because if they know me, they know that this stuff's important to me.
Yeah. It must be a really interesting, like, working space, because what you're doing inherently benefits people. But because of the disabled community and because of how we have been treated previously, and I'm not talking like yesterday, I'm talking like historically previously, the idea that somebody would want to help us just for the sake of just like being a good person can sometimes really, no, but it can really be lost on us, because we have all had some form of experience where we've been used as charity, or we've been used as, you know, like, oh, you're the token disabled person, or, you know, oh, I'm literally just doing this to get a good name, or I'm doing this to get my name out there as a good human being, like I'm a humanitarian, or I'm an anthropologist. You know, there are so many reasons as to why disabled people are not always the most trusting of the non-disabled who work in this space. But actually, you're right. Everybody who I've spoken to about you has completely backed you up 100%. I'm joking.
I'm so glad.
That
would have been terrible, wouldn't it? Oh, yeah. I'm sure he's... Yeah. No.
It must be a really interesting workspace to be in because of that. But it's not like you're not aware of it. And have there been any experiences where you've had to kind of almost like take a step back and have a look at your privilege and kind of explain that in a way that's accessible to different people who might not understand that?
Yeah, so I don't beat myself up about my privilege. I know who I am. I know where I am. I totally accept it and embrace it, but I use it for good, I hope. And I want to put myself in a position where the privilege that I have, if other people see it, they go, he's one of these privileged guys. Why would he be involved in this? And like 2020, I think 2019, I was nominated for the National Diversity Award for Businessman of Excellence or something like that. And I didn't win it. But then the following year, I actually won it. And I was like, what the frick? Because I'm middle-aged, white, single, non-disabled, straight guy.
So much diversity in one.
I'm the most opposite of diverse. It's just like, oh my God, how could I possibly be arguing for these things? But I just feel that until I can walk down, I'm in Edinburgh right now. If I walk down to Prince's Street and there's a march on, and I look at the makeup of the people in that march, I shouldn't be able to tell be able to tell why they're marching based on what they look like.
Yeah.
I should look at them and go, I wonder what they're marching about. I should look at the placards and maybe see some placards. But I shouldn't go, they're all disabled. They're marching for disabled people. Oh, they're all black. They're all marching for an ethnic minority or something like this. Or they're all, whatever it might be, Muslim or something like this. And you just go, I want to look down and I want to see people defending the rights of other people. And I don't think that is down to who's actually in that group. Hello, I'm just doing a podcast. I'll speak to you later. Bye. I'm looking after a dog and the dog has just come back and it is a absolutely beautiful wolf cross. And I know that in a couple of minutes time, it's going to howl. So it will be quite good fun, me going.
I mean, if he howls, that's great. Like, my dog's been barking in the background the entire time. I'm just hoping that it isn't, like able to be picked up. I have a feeling everyone's going to be like, oh, my God, what has she done to that poor dog? He's fine. He's absolutely fine. He's just a bit of a drama queen, but then he can really be mine and not be
that dog's. I love him. Anyway, yes, so that kind of interrupted the flow there a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking about, I really like the point that you made actually about if you were to look down Prince's Street and you saw people marching, you don't want to be able to tell what they're marching for. You should just know that they're marching for a reason. And actually, we don't necessarily have that in today's society. You know, you're right. If there's a whole host of people in wheelchairs at the Lions, they're marching for disabled rights. If we see a whole like ethnic minority, they're marching for like Black Lives Matter or, you know, something to do with Palestine, particularly that at the minute is a very pressing topic. So actually what you said about you shouldn't be able to tell what people are marching for is actually really key, because that becomes more about humanity as a whole rather than, you know, these intersections of different minorities that we have as people. Now, that's not me trying to put one minority group against the other, because I think that's actually really futile. And actually, you know, minority groups, we should all kind of work together. But there's something really important to be said in that you can tell what people are marching for when you look at who's marching.
Yeah. And I want to try and find ways for us to get through that, because we will not. And I caveat this by saying I understand the strength of flocking with your own, or flying with your own flock. And I understand that. And we need to get strength from other people. And I totally understand that. But until we get past that and start welcoming other people into our groups, we're going to be seen is a minority promoting our minority need. And I think we just need to be looking at a human need. I might be, I nearly started quoting John Lennon there. I don't think I'm the only dreamer. I know there are more out there. I work with lots of non-disabled people in this space who I think the world of, and I just wish they got more people looking at them and going, do you know what? That's a quality ally. That's a quality ally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've kind of spoken a bit about what you do now, but let's really dive into welcome, because I think what it does is really invaluable. Where it is incredible. And if more people know about it, then more people use it. And therefore, it means that life kind of becomes a bit more accessible and a bit easier for disabled people.
Yeah, well, fundamentally, if you think about this, I'm the most unlingual person in the world. I speak a little bit of Croatian and a little bit of Polish and English. but I don't speak any other language. But I could potentially say, hello, my name is, in any language in the world. If you said to me, Gavin, I want you to say, hello, my name is, in Nigerian, in half an hour's time, I'd go on YouTube and I would go, all right, okay. And I'd watch somebody saying it and I would go, all right, I think I can approximate that. And then half an hour later, I could say, hello, my name is, in any language on the planet. And that is not about knowing stuff. That's about knowing you need to know stuff. So if I knew half an hour before that I need to know something, I can know it. But what we currently do with everything is we learn stuff at the start of our lives or at the start of a job or in university, and then we're expected to remember that stuff for the rest of our lives. It's like you learn French, and then at the age of 40, you go to France, and then you go, oh, wait a second, you learned French, Gavin. How come you can't speak French? Well, I haven't used it for 20-odd years. Of course I can't speak French. Or you just don't feel comfortable. And I think that's the same for disability awareness. We are all, and this is the same. I work in pan-disability. I work in every single disability. Every single disability group expects people to understand their particular needs, be that autism, visual impairment, hearing impairment, neurodiversity, whatever it might be. Everybody expects people to know their needs, but they can't. And you can't expect that of a 19-year-old working in Starbucks who's there for 6 weeks and then they're finished their summer holidays and then they're away again. You just can't expect that. So we have to look at ways that we can deliver that training. And that's where Welcome came in. And that was what I was referring to earlier with the mobile phone. It, and also the empowerment of the individual, not Gavin doing it, because Gavin wants to be removed from the picture. But by me saying I'm going to a particular venue, I can say in my profile, I can say I'm a visually impaired person and I use a guide dog. And I have that in, and my name's Gavin, and this is what I look like. And then if I say I'm going to a venue and I use a tool like this, at the very least, it would say, this is what Gavin looks like. Gavin is a guide dog owner, and Gavin is here to buy such and such a thing. But because it's digital, that can also then trigger, this is what it means to be visually impaired. Here are some top tips on how to interact with Gavin when he arrives. Here are some links to some further training. If Gavin's arriving tomorrow, here's a video on sighted guide. If Gavin is has a hearing impairment and uses BSL, here is an opportunity to learn hello, my name is in BSL, which could totally change the interaction. I can get information before Gavin walks through the door, but it's Gavin that's prompting that by saying he's going. So that's what we did that and launched it in 2018, at the end of 2018. And we had five venues in Edinburgh. And then we had this pandemic that came around, which kind of put the knockers on anything and mockers on anything to do with customer service. But since the sort of opening up of the world again, we're up at something like 220 venues across the UK now, all using Welcome. And they pay a monthly subscription to use to offer the platform. But of course, they get better trained staff and they get better relationships with the disabled people who come through the door. And we've got about, must be about 15,000 profiles on the platform now of disabled people who use it for free. So they just set up a profile, look at the venues that are using it, say I'm coming to that venue. If you say you're going to the venue, that will trigger training in the venue for that staff member. And this is key. This was key from the very start. The training that person receives because I say I'm going is useful to the next disabled person who comes through the door, whether they're using Welcome or not. So the way I see it is if 10 in 100 people use Welcome in a particular venue, the people in that venue are going to be better with all 100 of those disabled people. And that was built into the process. It's just constant staff training.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting having that idea that you have to build a profile and you know, set it all up and then, you know, be like, oh, I'm coming to see you guys tomorrow, which, you know, non-disabled people don't have to think about. But actually for disabled people, like, our lives are very structured like that when we have outings and we go to different places and the research that we do in those places. And so actually to be able to almost have like a hub on an app on your phone where you can be like, okay, I'm going to go here. They use this app. Brilliant. Amazing. I'm going to let them know that I'm coming. Perfect. All done, all dusted. And I'm going to have a nice interaction. It's kind of invaluable because we don't always get those interactions.
Yeah. I'm going to sort of like argue against myself for a second here. Disabled people shouldn't have to tell people that they're coming. I 100% agree with that. You shouldn't have to say I'm coming, but restaurants, doctors, surgeries, optometrists, healthcare workers, pharmacies, you let these people, we all let these people know we're coming. If that mm-hmm. triggers training in that venue, brilliant. You know I'm coming. I want you to know a little bit more about multiple sclerosis. I want you to know what it is to live with a stammer. I want you to know that I'm dyslexic before I turn up, because I'm just about to sign up to your leisure center, and filling in the form will mean that I take it away with me and get somebody to fill it in instead of joining on the day that I turn up. So there are good reasons to actually let somebody know that you're coming. We do it all the time. But of course, for venues that you've never been to before, it's also a fantastic opportunity to say, I'm a bit nervous going. In fact, I won't go. Oh, we're saying I'm a bit nervous going, but they've got welcome. Brilliant. I'm more likely to go now because I can let them know about my needs before I turn up. And of course, you don't have to use welcome, but you might be keeping your fingers crossed that somebody in the past has, because their use of it will have helped you.
Yeah. What has the response to welcome been like?
From everybody.
Just from everybody, because I can't see. Obviously, like, I'm coming at this from very, very fresh eyes, very, very fresh perspective. I can't see why people wouldn't want to use it. But what has the response been like? Because we all know change is not always the easiest thing to implement.
So we split it into three, actually. I'll split it into three. I was going to say disabled people, businesses, but I'm going to add in investors here as well, because that's an important aspect. I'll come to that last, but and it's really, really important, but I will come to it last. But disabled people have been like, oh, wow, yeah. Well, initially they've been a bit, that's just too much hassle. It's going to be a bit of a pain. But when they've used it, they've gone, oh my God, I've turned up, and they treated me like a VIP. We had a chap go into a Levi's store, because we've been working with Levi's just recently in 13 of their stores. And he went in and he came out and he tweeted, I will never use another brand ever again. He was there for 2 hours. They knew he was after a pair of jeans. They tailored the jeans while he was in the store. They tailored it.
Amazing.
And he left, I will never go anywhere else. And that was just phenomenal, obviously. And people who've used it have gone, I didn't know this was possible. I didn't know this was possible. But it is, because this exists. So I've had lots of disabled people say, I love it, absolutely love it. I wish it was in more places. I want it all over the place. Staff members have been saying things like, I had a staff member using it once who was shaking. They were quite nervous, thinking, I'm going downstairs to meet somebody I've never met before, and I've got all this stuff that I need to remember. So I was talking to a staff member who put this into practice, and they were really quite nervous before they went to meet the disabled person, but they went downstairs, met the disabled person, came back, and they were just buzzing. They had goosebumps. They were like, I've never been able to deliver customer service like that in my life. I introduced myself. I didn't talk to the dog. I offered my arm. I walked at that pace. I didn't say things like it was over there. I got them a coffee. I got them to a seat. I showed them where the seat was. They said, thank you very much. That's the best service I've had. It was just like, and they were buzzing, because they, you don't get into customer service if you want to give bad customer service, but you, to get good feedback is just awesome, which is obviously what we do with Welcome. But we had a staff member in a shop recently contact me afterwards and said, this is going to change everything for everyone.
Yeah.
Seriously.
And that's the goal, right? That is the goal.
Yeah. This is going to change everything for everyone. If you say to a business, would it be useful to know who's going to walk through the door in half an hour? The answer is invariably yes. If you say to a disabled person, would you like to avoid that clunky moment when you walk through the door where you don't know where you're going to, whether you're going to get good customer service or not, they will say, hell yeah. I want to go somewhere without anxiety about arriving somewhere, which is ultimately what Welcome does. It helps the arrival. But lastly, the investor. I was massively connected with charity for such a long time. I thought, this needs to be a charity. And then I realized that there was no growth in it being a charity, and I would have to spend maybe 60% of my time trying to raise funds. And I wanted this to grow. And I thought a social enterprise, but then there are so many challenges with what you do with that money, and it's difficult to grow. And you don't get investors because they know they're not going to get dividends or be able to sell the company in a few years' time. But then I thought, right, well, if I'm a limited company and I get investors, then the investor can get a return from my company. And because I've got this wodge of investment, I can then grow the company and then spread this tool into North America, Australia, China, India, South Africa, Africa, Middle East, Europe. I mean, I can spread this tool all around the world if I've got people going, do you know what? I'm going to get a good return on my money if I put money into this company. Mm-hmm. So that was massively important for me to be able to make sure everybody won.
Yeah, and it was really interesting what you just said about disability and charity. So I had a really interesting conversation with the founder of Sociability. And Matt, what he said...
Matt's brilliant.
Love Matt. Matt is great. Love him. Fabulous guy. But something he said that really struck a chord with me is how we view disability in business. And it always tends to be about charity. And actually how that's incredibly lazy, because we kind of completely remove the idea that disabled people can be businessmen, or, you know, that, like, heaven forbid, we could actually want money for our expertise. And that idea surrounding business, money and disability is actually a really complex area to try and navigate and traverse because of that idea of charity, and because the charity model is so, so prominent, particularly in the UK, because when we think about charity, we think about all the people it's going to benefit, which is great. But also we think about that disability only really gets supported by charity. Cool. You know, we haven't quite understood the fact that actually disability is supported by a lot more than charity these days. And that maybe that comes because we have like a welfare state. Maybe it comes from the fact that we have the NHS. We do have these free organisations that you can use. But actually, the idea that we can make money surrounding businesses with disability, or the disability businesses that are, you know, aiming at improving the life of disabled people can make money, is something that we're really struggling to grapple with at the minute.
Well, we know the Purple Pound exists, but what we haven't found is direct routes to getting it through the door. And that's why work that we've been doing recently is just so massive. And sorry if I've cut off the question, but we were approached by, well, this year we've started working with Levi's in 13 stores. Mm-hmm. And just 2 weeks ago, we launched with Currys. And Currys now have Welcome in 20 stores across the West Midlands. So anybody from Stafford to Worcester can go to their local Currys using Welcome and be met by a staff member who understands their needs. Now, I love working with these organizations, but I understand what they're trying to do is trying to find ways to prove that the Purple Pound exists. And
yeah.
They said to us, right, well, we're putting this in place, but you need to help us prove that it exists. So over a period of 6 weeks, we need 50 people to walk through the doors of those Curry stores in the West Midlands. If we can get 50 people to walk through the doors of those Curry stores, we can prove that the Purple Pound exists. Whether they spend money or not, we can say, yeah, we know that people want to shop in person. And Currys are massively into this. I love what Currys have been doing with the Quiet Hours, and they work with Purple Tuesday, and they've done some brilliant stuff with the Sunflower Lanyard Scheme. But this is the next step for them. They want to be able to provide the training for their staff members based on the needs of the person who's going to be coming through the door. So, yeah, that's a big one for us right now, is proving the Purple Pound actually exists, because we talk about it all the time. But business needs to have proof. It can't just be us saying, theoretically, you could access this money. We need to blooming prove it. And that's on disabled people by actually using the opportunities to prove that it exists. We can't sit back and wait for things to come to us. But I understand why we do. The charity model is such a successful one. It's been around for such a long time. Even if you look up, if you go to Collins James or the Oxford English Dictionary and you look up the word charity, the provision of services or financial support for those in need. That's the definition of charity. We have to remove the need. Now, charity must exist. We have to have charity because there are people who will not get support unless charity exists. But we can't have it there as a, don't worry, if you're not being catered for, there's charity.
Yeah, almost like a safety net, like a foolproof, like it's almost like it's the back door. You can always have your foot in the back door.
And charity helps people over the barriers. It doesn't necessarily remove the barriers. If all the barriers were removed, the only charities we'd be working with would be the health related charities where you needed mental health or physical health, where you were in pain and or something that was incredibly challenging for you to just be able to get by and out of bed every single day. So we need those. But if the charity is there in order to, I don't know, remove, if a charity existed that just worked on removing stairs and putting in ramps, if all businesses had ramps, there is no need for that charity to exist. So we have to work towards the removal of the barrier, and the charity model doesn't necessarily get us towards that. And I'm hoping that we're able to do that and prove it by saying, yeah, the Purple Pound does exist and you can access it if you put into practice something that removes barriers.
Gosh, there's so much to unpick in that, isn't there? Like, and you're right with the charity model. It does, it very much helps you over the barrier, but doesn't necessarily eliminate the barrier. And that's kind of how you keep charity where it is. And that's not me shitting on charity. It's absolutely not, because I think it's absolutely vital. But you're right. Actually, we've kind of come to a point in time. And I mean, like, time for the human race. I don't mean like time as in like, oh, it's nearly lunchtime. We've kind of come to this time where actually we should be looking at removing the barriers, because the barriers that were put in place a long time ago, before we had technology, before we had the ability to explore and discover, and kind of, like you said, kind of tying quite nicely back into the point that you made about disabled people in the workforce, or just like in life. Just
thinking about this.
You know, disabled people are still there. So actually we've kind of come to that point where we need to remove the barriers, because actually we need to start building a more accessible world, because disability isn't going anywhere. You know, it's here to stay.
It's getting bigger. It's getting bigger. But we also need to make sure that we provide services. So there's a great example. A young chap, he's 25 years old. He's just a software whiz. He's the best computer programmer. He's got the most amazing CV. He's designed games and software for everything. And he goes out and has a motorbike accident. And he loses the use of his legs. Does that make him a bad software programmer? No, he's still the best software programmer. But if he can't get into your building, you can't utilize his skills. Blumen, make sure he can get into your building, because he's going to be brilliant for you. And that's somebody who maybe becomes disabled. But trust me, there are brilliant software programmers out there who are congenitally disabled. And they're just desperately trying to find work. 50% of disabled people are of a working age are in employment. That's a mad stat. It should be as many people in employment as non-disabled people. Or if not that, then of course, I come back to the caveat around pain and the challenges that people have with getting in and out of bed or whatever it might be. So we'll always have that as a caveat. But even somebody who's in bed can still work. If it's something that they're passionate about doing and have the skills to do it, they will have a job out there that they can do now. And we know that they can do it because we're living in a world where I'm working from home, you're working from home. We're able to do that. Whether I was a wheelchair user or you were a wheelchair user, it wouldn't matter, because we're able to pick and choose when we do a podcast or something like that. So yeah, remove the barriers and then make sure that next time I'm on that particular road, those barriers aren't there next time.
Gosh, this has been one of those chats where my brain has thought of about 100 different things all at once. And I love these kind of conversations, because actually we're talking about now, like what it looks like now, but also we're looking more towards the future, because it's not always just about us. Like people have had me say it before, I say it again, I'm a big believer of bringing people up with you as you're going up and thinking about the future generation, because let's be honest, like, we're humans, we're gonna procreate, there's gonna be more people, the planet is only gonna get bigger and more densely populated, and that also means more densely populated with disabled people. So if you can make disabled lives easier now but also in the future, then that's so worthwhile. And I think what you do with Welcome is really brilliant, because there can be awkwardness from both sides, particularly when we're talking about disability, particularly a disabled person. Like we've already said this, I don't really need to reiterate this point, but going into a place where, in like a coffee shop, like you said, but then also the flip side of that is if you're the barista and you've never really come across disability before in your life, it isn't your fault that you don't know how to have that interaction. You've just never been shown something before. And you don't know what you don't know until you're shown it. And so I think having that app there to be able to be like, hey, heads up, this is going to happen. Here's a little bit of like sideline training. You can have a quick look, glance over it. You'll learn something. And also you'll make that interaction so much better for yourself.
Yes.
So much better for the other person. Why would you not do it? And isn't that a great thing that we're looking for? Like the future can only ever get brighter using that.
Imagine having an ally in a shop that you've never been to.
Yeah.
And knowing that you have an ally there already, who already is wanting to deliver a better service for you before you get there, you're more likely to want to go to that shop or business or hospital or health center or wherever it might be, cinema or theater or museum or art gallery or gardens or travel, train station or airport. Or if you know you're going to be met by somebody who goes, yep, got it covered, mate, let's do it. You're more likely to want to go there. And the other thing I would say is, because, I mean, we're doing an amazing piece of work right now with the Disability Policy Center to get more people into voting and more people into in-person voting or just voting in general and looking at the challenges and the barriers to voting. If we get more people voting, more disabled people voting, that will then reflect in the people they vote for and what how much they care about disabled people's needs. We will also have more disabled people wanting to become people who everybody votes for. And then that will represent people. We'll have more disabled people in employment, more disabled people in parliament, more disabled people as councillors, more disabled people actually putting forward the needs for disabled people. And if we just think of 83% of disabled, of people on the world, everybody, 83% of people are at some point in their life going to be disabled. That is only going to help all of us.
Yeah. I actually think that that is a bloody perfect place to stop this conversation, because something, you know, you really encapsulated everything that we spoke about in that last point. And it's been so great to have this conversation, because we've not only just spoken about what Welcome does, but we've also spoken about allyship and why that's important. And I think that's sometimes something that we completely forget. We completely forget that whilst it's great for disabled people to scream and shout about what they need and what they want and their rights, actually, we sometimes do need a helping hand. And that is everybody. Like, everybody at some point in their life needs some help, and they need some help to go through the barriers, like you said, to take the barriers away. And that's been brilliant as well. So I really want to thank you for that, because it's been wonderful to have this conversation about allyship, because I think that's important. And also, I'd probably go one step further. I think there's differences between allyship and being an accomplice. And I'd actually probably say you're more of an accomplice than you are an ally.
That sounds kind of criminal.
Yeah, but I kind of like that, because I think all disabled people are rebels. The fact that we even just like choose to be here and be who we are and don't give in to this society's idea that, you know, we should be this one homogenized group is actually really pretty rebellious. So if you're joining us, you might as well be an accomplice rather than an ally.
I will accept that invitation. Thank you.
Also, I think I would be so good at robbing banks. I lie.
In which case, Brooke, I'm there with you. Although, maybe don't put this bit live, because the last thing you want to is remove your ally, your alibi, by saying that you want to rob banks.
I think we all know that I'm like about as sus as a sledgehammer, so I would be terrible.
We finished on really beautiful, powerful points there, and we've just completely undermined it all by talking about robbing banks. Seriously, we had this like beautiful sentence of like, and that is the key point. Oh, would you like to rob a bank?
Yeah, I know. This is how my brain works, though. Like, it's the neurodiverse person in me. It's like, it was a great point, but I need to like throw in a spanner.
It would be my.
But seriously, thank you so much for coming on today to explain about Welcome, about allyship. It's been a really insightful chat. So thanks for giving up your time and coming on.
Oh, a real pleasure. And I'll just finish by saying, if people want to find out about Welcome, just go to well-co.me. Well-co.me, and that's our website. And if they sign up, there's lots of information there under the visitors tab. If they sign up, then they can go and visit Currys. They've got until the 28th of April if they're in the West Midlands. If they're not in the West Midlands, let a friend know who is in the West Midlands, or post about it on their social media. And I'll leave some links on this talk. And well done, you, by the way. 101, is this 101 podcasts?
This is 101.
That is phenomenal. I need to look at the full list of people. I know a lot of the people, I listened to Nick Wilson's one, thought that was an absolute corker, and Isaac Harvey and people like that. You just go, ah, these are the people I know and yeah, and admire so much. Well done, you.
Oh, madness. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Disabled and Proud. If you've enjoyed the show, then please give it some love by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts. It really helps us to reach more and more people each week. Plus, if you've got a particular highlight, then I'd absolutely love to hear it. Tag me on your Insta stories at Disabled and Proud Podcast.